Tracing the Flow of the Don River Through Time, an interview with Jennifer Bunnell, and Finding Environmental History Online, I speak with Adam Krimble, the website administrator for the Network in Canadian History and Environment. I'm Sean Courage, and this is Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. Welcome to the premier podcast of Nature's Past. Before we begin this episode, I thought I would take a moment to set out the parameters and purposes of this podcast. First, this podcast will survey research in the field of environmental history in Canada through interviews, book reviews, roundtable discussions, and lectures to help get a better idea of what scholars are studying across the country. Second, we'll try to look beyond academic research to find out what role history can play in contemporary environmental issues. And third, we want to promote upcoming events and activities in environmental history going on in Canada and around the world. And finally, we'll try to keep things open and flexible for listeners to offer suggestions on new directions that the podcast can take that we might have overlooked. To do this, we invite you to post your thoughts, questions, and ideas to the comments section of our show page on the Niche website at niche.uwo.ca/naturespast. But first, what is environmental history? For those of you who are new to the field, it makes sense to briefly begin by asking the question, what is environmental history? This is a question that environmental historians seem to ask a lot. The field first emerged in the late 1960s and 1970s in the United States alongside the modern environmental movement, but it has antecedents in the work of French social historians from the Annales school, as well as early historical geographers. Prominent scholars in environmental history have attempted to define the discipline through various surveys of the field over the past 38 years. Roderick Nash, author of Wilderness in the American Mind, was one of the first to write up a broad statement of the state of environmental history in 1970. Nash argued that environmental history was a form of reading the physical landscape as a historical document to understand the social values inscribed by humans in a given environment. In short, environmental history was the study of, according to Nash, what men have done to and thought about the physical world. Since then, the definition of the field of environmental history has broadened considerably. Rather than solely considering the impact of humans on the non-human world, environmental history now looks at the reciprocal relationship between humans and non-human nature. Donald Worster's 1988 essay, Doing Environmental History, embraced the idea of studying this reciprocal relationship and treating non-human nature as a historical actor. He argued that environmental history rejects the conventional assumption that human experience has been exempt from natural constraints, that people are a separate and supernatural species, that the ecological consequences of their past deeds can be ignored. In Alfred Crosby's 1995 essay, The Past and Present of Environmental History, he makes a powerful argument for all historians to adopt an ecological perspective on the past. In this sense, Crosby framed environmental history as a way of viewing history with a lens that was sensitive to non-human nature as well as humans as biological actors in global ecosystems. According to Crosby, historians were purblind in considering environmental matters. Broadly speaking, we can understand environmental history as the history of human interactions with non-human nature in which both humans and non-human actors are co-actors in past events. It is a subfield of history that is deeply interdisciplinary and attempts to bridge the divide between the humanities and natural sciences. And finally, Environmental history is a way of looking at the past from an ecological perspective that considers the biological role of humanity in a global ecosystem. Environmental history seeks out stories of the complicated relationship between humans and the rest of nature, even in what would, at first glance, seem to be a most unnatural environment, the city of Toronto. Jennifer Bunnell, a PhD candidate at the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education at the University of Toronto, has been looking at nature in the city of Toronto from the perspective of the Don River in her dissertation titled Imagined Futures and Unintended Consequences, An Environmental History of Toronto's Don River. This 38-kilometer-long river drains from its headwaters in the north at the Oak Ridges Moraine into Lake Ontario, less than 2 kilometers to the east of downtown Toronto, passing through Canada's most highly urbanized environment. From the 1880s into the 20th century, the river has been the site of intense industrialization and urbanization. Throughout its complicated history, the river's human neighbors have viewed and perceived the Don River Valley in various ways, often as peripheral or marginal urban space. Today, most Torontonians only briefly engage with the river as a highway thoroughfare as they cruise, and more often crawl, through the Don Valley Parkway, one of the busiest highways in the country. To find out more about this river and its history, I spoke with Jennifer about her dissertation research.
My name is Jennifer Bunnell. I'm a fourth-year PhD student at the University of Toronto, and I'm working on a dissertation on the social and environmental history of the Don River in Toronto.
Thanks for joining us, Jen. What role did the Don River play in the foundation of what would become Canada's largest metropolis?
Well, it has kind of a funny role because it's a small river compared to something like the Fraser or the St. Lawrence. It's only 38 kilometers long. But it does play quite a significant role in the founding of Toronto. There's some suggestion that in the days before European settlement, that the voyagers used it as a conduit to reach Lake Simcoe, at least in part. They paddled partly up the river. But other than that, it doesn't seem to have had much use. It only appears on several, just a handful of early maps in the French regime. But when Simcoe arrives on the scene, he decides to place his town site very near the mouth of the river, which actually later people question why he does this, because it's a very marshy, lowland site. But he talks about these stands of white pine that are further upriver that might provide excellent masts for shipbuilding. And he notes the beauty of the site that he's chosen for his future town plot. It also, the river sort of hugs the very eastern edge of Toronto Harbour, and I think he sees it as a good vantage point for the location of a town. He sets aside a government reserve for government buildings just west of the river, and there's some suggestion that he intended to build a shipyard there, but as we'll see as we continue to talk, Simcoe's plans don't really turn out as he'd hoped. But you know, after that initial period, the Don becomes very important as a site for a number of mills which supply the growing town of York with lumber and paper and later bricks from the many brickworks along the valley. So, for example, by about 1860, there's over 50 mills that are clustered along the various branches of the Don and its tributaries. So it becomes very significant as an industrial river, despite its very small size.
And now you said that in the late 18th and early 19th century, the end of the river down by the lake is marshy and different than what we might imagine the end of the Don River, if very many Torontonians even go down to where the Don meets Lake Ontario today. Can you describe the difference between how it appears today and how it would have appeared in the late 18th century?
Sure. For those people who haven't ventured into the maze of highway overpasses and concrete that is the mouth of the Don today, it essentially forms a right-angle turn into Keating Channel, and the lower reaches of the river and the mouth are completely encased in concrete. It's surrounded by what was once the city's port industrial district, which is now largely derelict, and surrounded by the overpasses of the Gardner. So it's quite difficult to actually find the mouth of the Don if you're on foot, because of this maze of transportation corridors. There's also a rail line coming through there as well. So it's a very understated and really derelict place now. Mm-hmm. In 1793, when the town of York was founded, this was a very different place. In fact, the mouth of the Don, the river opened up into one of the largest wetlands, perhaps the largest wetlands in eastern Canada, Ashbridges Bay Marsh, which was about 1,300 acres in size, and according to early settlers of the time, was teeming with wildfowl. It was a popular site for fishing. There were sort of paths that weaved through the marsh, parts of the marsh were you could walk through by foot, but much of it was very wet. And in fact, it's difficult to trace in early maps of the area what was water and what mm-hmm. was land. We've been in this GIS project I've been working on, really struggling with that, because early map makers also struggled with it. How do we define this very marshy, murky place that also constantly shifts? So with seasonal differences, different areas will be flooded. So the marsh really was somewhat of an amorphous space.
So originally the Don River was conceived as a suitable place to set up a city or a town. When did this perception of the river begin to change? When did Torontonians start to think about this place differently?
By about the 1850s, that really starts to shift, in that there's not only concern, growing concern, and even evident much earlier, about the marshlands and their potential for acting as an origin of disease through concerns about miasmas. So the idea that the marsh was producing, through rotting vegetable matter, these vapors that were dangerous to people's health, that were the cause of disease and that spread through especially night breezes. There's this growing association of the Don as an unhealthy place and a place that you don't want to locate your house next to. Mm. So there's a lot of language, there's even, in planning the city starts to shift away from the river. So we go from Simcoe's location of the center of the town of York, right at the mouth of the Don, which becomes the area for so much concern, only 50 years later. The city really starts to stretch northwest, mm-hmm. and there's some very deliberate statements about, well, we don't want to develop in the area east, which is sort of under a cloud of disease-producing miasmas. Mm. So there's that shift. There's also, I think, as the city moves northwest, the Don becomes increasingly distant from the center. So it becomes less convenient. It's also separated from the rest of the city by this large government reserve, which is largely forested until, the 1820s or 30s. So there's this impasse. Mm. And that's compounded by, further upriver, huge ravines. Anyone who's crossed the Don Valley in the subway or walked through the paths underneath the Bloor Street Viaduct, this was a large, gaping, mm-hmm. crevasse in the middle of the city that really impeded movement. And so that whole eastern area becomes not a very accessible place for people who had farms and, for example, needed to cross the area north of Girard, where there are no bridges until 1918. That compounded with increasing reports of sort of poor soils and limited agricultural potential around the Don, the notion of it as having an unpredictable riparian environment, so there's a long history of flooding, mm-hmm. and reputation for unhealthiness. So the language really starts to change, and the Don becomes an increasingly peripheral space. And indeed, until about the 1880s, the river actually forms the eastern boundary of the city. So it is mm-hmm. it is the edge until annexations on the east side of the river in the 1880s.
Right. So as the river becomes peripheral to the urban environment, how does that, in terms of perception of the river. How did that change the way people used the Don River?
Well, you know, one of the key aspects of my dissertation, I guess, is looking at it as looking at the river as sort of a repository for the city's waste. So it becomes a place for the externalization of wastes that are the necessary product of urbanization and city growth in this period. Where do those things go? Well, they seem to be pushed to the edges, and the Don is one of those edges. And as a flowing river, it forms that convenient function of moving waste downstream and out of sight. Because of its marshlands at mm-hmm. the mouth of the Don, waste didn't move completely out of sight and really kind of piled up at the mouth, and were the subject of a lot of debate and dispute in the 1880s and 90s particularly. But it definitely becomes this receiver place, and that really is still present today. I mean, mm-hmm. Water pollution is a huge concern in the late 19th century. You've got both industry, dumping of sewage, increasingly through the 19th century, and industrial waste is especially noxious around the Don. So it becomes a place for industries that weren't welcome elsewhere, for tanneries, for glue factories, later in the 19th century for oil refineries.
And so human perceptions, which are informed by the actual physicality of the river valley, actually inform the way in which people then end up using it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a direct connection. I don't think it's always perception informs use. I think there's the area had long been industrializing. We see tanneries along the Lower Don as early as 1820. So that history of so-called noxious industry is long, and certainly the early tanneries would have been situated on a more pastoral Don. But as the area, I think, becomes relegated to the edge, as it is no longer an important place in the development of the city, especially as steam power comes to replace water power. So the Don is no longer so important for mills and other industries further north. It becomes important mainly as a waste disposal device, mm-hmm. Rather than a source of water power, and certainly of water supply for industry. And you've got industry increasingly saying, like the breweries along the Don, saying, you know, we use piped water. We don't use water from the Don. You've got ice cutting being banned on the river later into the century, where people are starting to recognize just how contaminated this space is. So it's difficult to trace which comes first, but I think certainly among elite residents of the center, the Don is a place to avoid. And the social history of the river really mirrors that, in that property values around the river really plunge after the 1830s. And it becomes, in its lower reaches especially, where it's quite industrialized, a place a place for people that you wanted to avoid, typically. So there's which I can talk about as well. There's a long history of homelessness around the river, but there's also a history of crime, and of there's a group called the Brooks Bush Gang, who lives in a woodlot just near the Queen Street Bridge off the Don, and is accused actually of murdering a local MPP in 1859. So there becomes not only this idea of miasmas and unhealthiness, but danger associated with the river valley.
Now, you also argue that there are other voices and other actors who perceive the river differently from, say, the city's elite. Could you talk a little bit about different perceptions of the river as perhaps not marginal space?
Yeah, sure. There's, I think, two main strands to this. There's a number of course, different voices over time, but the working class communities that build up around this industrialized part of the lower river from about the 1870s on, so this is Cabbage Town and Riverdale, there's a really interesting history here, in that many of these people who these areas were considered borderline slums, and certainly the subject of lots of social reformers in the latter 19th century. Mm-hmm. But many of these people worked for these polluting industries, and Gutermann Wartz Distillery is a big player here in that they're one of the largest polluters of the marsh and the lower river, in that they have huge cattle fattening operations, so they use the residue of their distilling process to fatten cows. And all of that cattle manure and waste gets drained directly into Ashbridge's Bay Marsh and it becomes the subject of a lawsuit with the city later on, in the 1880s. But interestingly, there's a petition from many of these working class residents saying, you know, we support Gutermann Wartz in this. This is our livelihood. If the rest of you can't handle that, there's a stench down here, you know, don't come. So there's that interesting backlash from their perspective. This is their home. Developers in the area sort of market these working class neighborhoods as places to walk to work. And there's sort of, an alternate history there to explore. But secondly, in an area that I've been especially interested in is the history of people who actually found refuge or lived in the valley itself. Mm-hmm. So these working class communities kind of form along the edges of the valley. But within the valley itself is an entirely different group of people at different times. So, I've got records, I guess, from as early as the 1830s, which talk about squatters along the river and along the waterfront. And like the Don, like I'm arguing for the Don, the city's waterfront is also one of these kind of backyard spaces, a space to dump waste, to throw your horse carcasses, to turn your back on. And the Don falls into that category, too. So you see evidence of squatting, and there was apparently a... Henry Scadding, who's one of my sources, talks about one of these squatters, Joseph Tyler, who lives in a cave near the mouth of the Don in the 1820s and 30s. The details are a little sketchy. But he sort of carves out this somewhat marginal existence, but somewhat successful at the same time, in that he carves a canoe out of a tree and uses it to ferry people across the river in times of high water. He ferries beer from the Halliwell Brewery into town, and he manufactures pitch and sells pitch in the city. So he uses the local resources around him from the forest near the Don, I imagine, to create something of a livelihood. As later on, so I sort of leapfrogged through time and tried to find evidence of others doing this. And the case of the Brooks Bush Gang, which I mentioned earlier, is also mm-hmm. really interesting, in that the trial record for this murder case, where they're accused of murdering John Sheridan Hogan, this local MPP, in 1859, and the trial record, which is recorded in the Globe, gives quite a bit of detail from their perspective on what daily life was like for them. And the fact that they used the Don daily as a conduit between the abandoned barn they lived in this woodlot in a valley, and the taverns and other storefronts near the Don Bridge at Queen Street. So just the way that the river factored into their lives and how they used that space, both as a place of refuge from authorities, as a meeting place, and as a place to lead a very different existence. And then early in the 20th century, there's evidence of groups of Roma family groups living in the valley, further north in the valley. Mm-hmm. And while, you know, the evidence is very sketchy, it's newspaper records I'm working with, and of course I'm seeing these people through the lens of their observers in the 1910s and 20s. Who certainly don't think much of you know, so-called gypsy squatters living on the Don, but kind of looking through that, you can see that these people are they're using the river in certain ways for water, for cooking. Their children swim in the river, it's reported. They're finding a place that's removed from the rest of the city, where they can live generally without being bothered by others, because the river further north is still quite rural at this time. So I found, you know, if I have very little evidence to work with there, but it's sort of part of that long train of semi-homelessness in the Don. And then finally, there's the history of the Depression era hobo jungle that forms near the brickworks on the flats of the river in the Don Valley.
Right.
In 1930 and 1931, and there's some really fascinating stories of these guys building caves and shacks out of saplings, and just using the resources around them to make themselves as comfortable as was possible. You know, digging through abandoned landfill sites to find found objects that they would furnish their dwellings with. So things like this I found really fascinating, and it kind of kept asking the question, why here? Why are these people finding themselves here?
Mm-hmm.
And it is because of that history of peripherality. It is a space that was, unused and available because it was less desirable.
We've talked a bit about how people have shaped the Don River. Why don't we talk a little bit how the Don River has shaped Toronto? And in particular, I'm thinking about Hurricane Hazel. What sort of impact did Hurricane Hazel have on the history of the Don River?
Hurricane Hazel in 1954 had a huge impact in that it really shifted the trajectory of development in the river. Now, there's a need to back up here in that the 1940s really saw some changes in attitude towards towards the environments in the Ontario area, in that you see the formation of conservation authorities as of 1946 across the province, coming out of farmers and naturalists and others' concerns about soil erosion and water quality and other concerns, flooding, etc. You see these sort of watershed-based planning groups forming, which are really significant in all of a sudden looking at this river and the water that flows into it from a much more holistic standpoint, as well as involving citizens. So you've got essentially citizens groups that are resourced and that have the capacity to think and commission some long-range plans for these watersheds. So that's the 40s, as well as a really strong local conservation movement spearheaded in Toronto by Charles Soriel, and his work really centers on the Don particularly. So this is sort of in the background, but it looks like many of the recommendations that these conservation authorities make in the 40s aren't really going anywhere. There's a big conservation report that's a massive document produced for the Don Valley in 1950. But it seems that, you know, much of what these planners are talking about in terms of the need to not develop in valley floodplains, to protect these areas as green belts, doesn't seem to be going anywhere as of early 1954. When Hurricane Hazel strikes in October of that year, all of a sudden the landscape shifts in that planners and politicians and residents across the city all of a sudden look to these river valleys that carve up the city from east to west as really central drainage corridors, as vital corridors in times of flood and in times of a central flood like Hurricane Hazel. And you see after that the amalgamation of several conservation authorities in 1957 to form the Metro Toronto and Region Conservation Authority, which has a lot more power. And you see them all of a sudden start to acquire huge swaths of land in the Don Valley to protect it from development. So there's plans before that to put, and certainly plans that have gone through, to put apartment buildings and stuff backing onto ravines to allow housing right up to the valley banks and some development within the valley itself. Well, you see the Conservation Authority expropriating existing landowners in the valley and buying up whatever they can, as well as implementing large sort of mega project type flood control projects. So a real shift towards, you know, not 1990s kind of ecological restoration or conservation,
right.
but conservation in the sense of flood control and protection for mm-hmm. for city residents. So, you know, the heritage that we have today in terms of huge amounts of green space in the valley were I think, the result of Hurricane Hazel really making very clear the recommendations of those reports from the 1940s.
What sort of sources have you been using to research the history of the Don River, and what have been the major challenges in finding sources, using different types of difficult sources for understanding the history of a river?
Okay. Well, there's actually a huge amount available on the Don. There's, I guess the 19th century has been certainly more of a challenge than the 20th century, and that I'm focusing on both of those periods. In doing an environmental history, my time period is long, and that's been, I guess, one of my major challenges is how to put some bounds on this project, both in terms of geography and in terms of time.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that I'm dealing, you know, I'm looking at a river, it seems it's only logical to look at the entire watershed to do this river justice.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I find that most of the historical developments that are that are recorded, at least, are happening in the lower valley. And so I found that just by default, much of my discussions are concentrating on that area south of Bloor Street,
right.
Which is not a river history, which is a history of a section of a river. So I've been wrestling with that in terms of, you know, larger settlement further upriver was largely, you know, involved clearing and agricultural use for well into the 20th century. So how much to tell that story, I'm still wrestling with. Then there's the time question, when to start a river history like this. And I wanted to avoid that, I think, that pithole pitfall in some environmental histories where you sort of start at the beginning and you tell the geological foundations of this place and then you carry on from there. I wanted to somehow weave that into the narrative as I move.
Mm.
And so I'm actually going to be covering you know, significant geological history of the valley through the eyes of one of the geologists who uses one of the brickwork quarries to make some really interesting discoveries about glaciation. So, you know, I'm hoping to pursue that through other means. But back to the question of sources, there's a ton to work with. The visual record for the Don is really stunning, and I think will have to be the subject of some article or something, in that some of my key sources are looking at this history of both maps and photography over time. There's a long history of sort of pastoral landscape photography of the Don and further upriver. And then there's sort of a history of industrial development on the Don that's all recorded in great detail in photographs by the Toronto Port Authority. Lantern images, et cetera. So I've got a huge amount to work with there. Textual sources have included everything from city council minutes to various reports made by city committees over time and occasionally by provincial committees on major issues that they were tackling, like water supply, water pollution, etc. I've also found, as I mentioned, with the Brooks Bush Gang, the legal history, some of the trial records around the Don, both in terms of the social history of the area and there's some court cases around the pollution of the lower river that have been very illuminating in terms of the kind of language people used and the issues that were coming up around the river in the late 19th century.
What's the current imagined future of the Don River? What is the future direction that the city or activists or conservation groups that are seeing how the Don should be used today?
Well, it's funny you ask that because I have become somehow Ms. Don River. There is a lot of interest and enthusiasm about yet another improvement for the Lower Don that's been circulating around Toronto for the last few years. And certainly, you know, one of the things I haven't talked about yet is, and may not have time today, is the great history of civic activism around the Don from, through the 20th century, from Charles Sorrell in the 40s and on, to the pollution probe, for example, has a funeral for the Don in 1969, which is a real catalyst for civic activism. And then in 1989, you have the formation of the task force to bring back the Don, and they've just done a huge amount to raise public awareness about the river and to make some pretty transformative changes in small ways. So just with that context, they've been pushing for a long time to see some change in the Don. Mm. And there's currently a plan by Waterfront Toronto with some buy-in from various levels of government to completely revision the mouth of the Don. And so they had a huge design competition. They had all these community stakeholder events where they got people's input on the the proposed designs. And they're currently in the process of a very detailed and comprehensive environmental assessment for the river. But I've just found out that the amount of funds that they have to actually implement this project, and it was supposed to begin in, begin around 2012 and take close to 25 years. 15, they said, to actually, be able to see some of the major changes proposed. Mm-hmm. That funding for implementation is no longer secure. So as much as there's huge amounts of planning and expensive planning going on for this reconceived mouth of the Don, and just to give a bit of context for that, that right angle turn I talked about in terms of the Don flowing encased in concrete into that right angle turn into Keating Channel, the plan is to create more of a so-called natural mouth for the river and to naturalize the space around the mouth to make a gesture to its sort of marshland past. And the conservation authority that's been very much involved in the planning process is very sensitive about the terminology used around these plans. For example, they don't want the word restoration used because they don't want any sense that this place will become anything like the past landscape it was. So the idea is essentially to green the mouth of the Don, to pull it out of its concrete straight jacket, to make it more accessible, and to kind of make it the cornerstone of a revitalized neighborhood of, so there's plans for condominium development and storefronts, et cetera, in that area that has long been kind of a neglected and derelict space in the city, an underused space, even though it's right on the harbor and has all sorts of potential. Mm-hmm. So using the river as kind of what Jean Desfort, this geographer I'm working with, has called an agent of urbanization, really seeing it as a central force in transforming a particular district of the city, seems to be what's going on. Whether this will actually transpire is very much up in the air right now. I guess my interest in that is I plan to explore this somewhat in a final chapter and talk about how public memory of the river has been kind of mobilized in plans such as this plan to naturalize the mouth of the Don, and in plans over the years to restore certain aspects of the river. And to educate the public about what the river is or should be. I'm really interested in how much of the river's history and what parts of the river's history factor into those narratives around what is a healthy river.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading more about the Don River from you. Good luck with the rest of your research, and thanks for speaking with us today about the Don River.
Okay, thanks a lot, Sean.
There are many different resources out there on the internet for researchers interested in environmental history. For those of you in Canada, we recommend taking a look at the website for the Network in Canadian History and Environment at nich.uwo.ca. That's niche.uwo.ca. To find out more about this resource, I spoke with Adam Krimble, the webmaster for the Niche website.
My name is Adam Krimble, and I'm the website administrator for Niche, the Network in Canadian History and Environment, and I'm in charge of updating the website or putting up anything that people send in that they want broadcast to the community.
Great. So thanks for joining us, Adam. What sort of things can researchers and people who are interested in environmental history find on the Niche website?
Well, if they're interested in relevant news to the environmental history community, we do keep news on the front page of our website. We've also got lots of resources that we're starting to compile, and we've got some that are already well underway. So if somebody's creating a course, we've got a selection of syllabi that you can use as reference points. And if you're a student, we've got lists of the type of funding you can get or different courses and programs around the country if you're looking for that too.
And what sort of research resources are available on the site? Is there data that other researchers are compiling and putting together on the website?
Yeah, we have a range of bibliographies. So if you're interested in, for instance, birds, there's quite a selection of books and articles related to birds and Hudson Bay Company, climate change, things like that. And there's also one group that is working on early Canadian climate data, and they've started to assemble quite a selection of data from pre-1900 in Canadian sources that researchers can use.
I notice on the website there's a big directory with names of all different people who are researching environmental history in Canada. How does somebody get their name on that directory?
Actually, all of our members are on that directory, and if you want to get your name on there, all you have to do is sign up for a free niche membership, and you can do that on our website on the main page. On the left-hand side, there's a little button that says create a new account, and you can just input all your information, upload a photograph, tell people what your interests are, and then they can get a hold of you if they have similar interests.
And what other sort of things can you do once you've signed up as a member on the site?
Well, all of our members have a blog that they can contribute news to, and we've set it up so that anybody can contribute news, and then once it's been saved, we post it to the front page, so it's sort of like a newspaper article that anybody can read. So if you've got news, that's a great way to get it out to the community.
Right, so it's not just you posting stuff up there, but the users are also contributing.
Yeah, we've got lots of people that have put up articles in the last couple of weeks that are not me, but that are members.
And so what's new and coming up on the website?
Well, we've got a couple of the major projects, which are niche-funded core projects that have been working on updating the resources they have available. I know the Forest History Group is working hard to put together bibliographies and syllabi, and they're going to have that available in the next couple of weeks. And the same thing with the Early Canadian Climate Data Group. They're working on updating a lot as well. We're always looking for new resources. If people have ideas, we're happy to have them.
And how can people get in touch with you if they have an idea for something they'd like to put up on the website?
Well, we've got a contact button on the website. If you click on that, it's just on the left-hand side. You can send a message directly to me. Or if you want to just send us directly an email, you can do that. My email address, I'm in charge of all that. So my email address is adam_crymble@hotmail.com, and then I'll get your email.
And the website is niche.uwo.ca. Thanks for speaking with us, Adam, and giving us a bit more information about the site.
You're very welcome.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Jennifer Bunnell, Adam Krimble, and me, Sean Courage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes at niche.uwo.ca/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes and subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. Thanks for listening, and be sure to download our next episode.